Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want, coming to you from People's Dispatch. Today, it's just Prashant. We lost Zoe. We haven't lost her, just lost her voice. She'll be back next week. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter, coming to you every week. This is the 159th show, so at least 159 weeks, in fact, longer, because we had to skip some weeks. We've been with you for a long time, accompanying you, trying to bring you the important news from around the world. You might remember that in the U.S. administration of President Joe Biden, there's a person who's basically in charge of human rights, to some extent, the concept of genocide. In fact, she wrote a book on genocide. Her name is Samantha Power, an important figure in the human rights community, used to be at Harvard University and so on. Well, interestingly, after the International Court of Justice released orders saying that there is plausible evidence, plausibility of genocide being conducted by Israel against the people of Palestine in Gaza, after the International Criminal Court had said this, really within hours, the Israelis started to say that the principal UN agency, UNRWA, they were founded, in fact, during the catastrophe of 1948 and is the principal provider of education, health, and other services to the Palestinian people. The Israelis, who have hated UNRWA for a long time, accused UNRWA staff, at least about a dozen of them, of participating in one way or the other in the October 7th attack across the fence from Gaza. Well, a few days later, they reduced the number to less than five, from just over a dozen. They reduced the number just in a few days. A classic Israeli ploy. They sort of exaggerated the number and exaggerated the scale and then reduced it. By the way, over 150 UNRWA employees have been killed during this particular bombardment, just to put in context this numbers game. Well, you know, not only did Israel make the statement that UNRWA employees were involved in the attacks of October 7th, and therefore Israel said, not only did they make the claim, but they then said that funders of UNRWA should withhold their funding until UNRWA decides to go a different way. And so, lining up right behind Israel were a number of Western countries, Canada, the United States, and so on. And I was interested in listening to Samantha Power, who, again, has written a book on genocide, high official of the Biden administration, defending not only Israel's brutal bombing of the Palestinians in Gaza, but defending the defunding of a relief agency in the middle of what the International Court of Justice has said is a plausible genocide. In the middle of a plausible genocide, the high official of the U.S. government, who wrote a book on genocide, is okay with cutting funding to the one relief agency that might ameliorate the effects of this genocide. Now, what's interesting as well, yesterday, former UNRWA spokesperson said that, in fact, UNRWA wasn't even shown this evidence. This evidence was sent overseas to other countries. It was not even shared with UNRWA. There was no discussion with the UN agency to talk to them, to find out and verify if indeed the names on this Israeli list were actually UNRWA employees, or if somebody else had just conjured the name. There was no conversation with this UN agency, and immediately the Israelis accused it of terrorism. In fact, I must say, having covered the 2014 Operation Protective Edge bombing of Gaza, in which over 2,000 people were killed in a matter of just a few weeks, the Israeli government targeted a number of UN buildings, including UNICEF office, UNICEF being the UN Children's Fund. Interesting, one European country decided we are not going to stop funding UNRWA, and that's Belgium. Belgium said we're going to continue to fund UNRWA. Well, hours later, a Belgian-funded NGO was struck by Israeli bombs inside Gaza. Was that retaliation? Was that basically just an accident? I mean, cannot just be a coincidence that a Belgian-funded organization was struck immediately. What is very clear to anybody who's watching this, Prashant, what is very clear is this has got not really much to do with October 7th, because Israel has been after Anova for a long time. This has got to do fundamentally with the Israelis' demand that Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, in Jordan, and other places who avail themselves of UNRWA services no longer do so and have to therefore become citizens of Jordan, citizens of Lebanon, and suspend, or in fact, further than that, to annul their Palestinian citizenship. This is in fact a violation of the Security Council Resolution 194, which gives Palestinians the right to return. If UNRWA is closed down, then it becomes very difficult for Palestine to maintain themselves as Palestinian refugees who have a right to return. They now become citizens of Lebanon and other countries. Quite an outrageous set of events, but I really would oblige Samantha Power to once again go to her bookshelf, pull down her own book, and read her own book about genocide. She might learn a few things. So Samantha, if you're watching this, let's read the book together. We can do a kind of online discussion of it. Could be interesting. Or she could come on People's Dispatch, Prashant, and do an interview to talk about her book and so on. We'll give her enough airtime. Maybe an hour-long interview would be interesting. An hour-long interview not available for Imran Khan or his wife. Pakistan, part of one of these countries, 2 billion people or so that are going to have elections this year. Pakistan, some people in Pakistan decided through their wisdom, cancel Imran Khan and cancel his party. Prashant, tell us about that.
Right, Vijay. So what we're seeing, of course, is a campaign against Imran Khan that has been on for many, many months now. And it's interesting, of the two cases in which he was sentenced for 10 years in prison in one case and 14 years in the other. The first case is what is called the Cypher case. Now, the Cypher case, it's quite an interesting case because it refers to a particular document, a government document, which Imran Khan held aloft at a rally around the time he was basically deposed. And he said basically that there are foreign powers, you know, working to overthrow me. And later it turned out that the cipher involved was basically sent by a Pakistani diplomat with comments from an American diplomat saying that they would be, you know, all would be forgiven, were the words, if Imran Khan was to be overthrown in a no-confidence motion. Now, as you know, Imran Khan was overthrown in a no-confidence motion in April 2022, I believe. And just before he was overthrown, what had happened was that he had visited Russia around the time as the war broke out. He had kind of indicated that he was taking a position where he would, for Pakistan's energy and other needs, sort of continue to stick or at least maintain good relations with Russia. And then there was a very serious question as to whether the deep state in Pakistan, the establishment in Pakistan, which has really been in control for many of these years, would allow that to continue. And of course, as we know, the establishment largely comprises the military, which has kind of maintained, even which has either been in direct power through various coup d'etats, or has, you know, been the has treated politicians like puppets. And the fact was that it seemed increasingly unlikely that that would be allowed to continue, or Imran Khan's defiance would be allowed to continue. And as you can guess, it was not. He was first of all deposed and then hit with a barrage of cases. We're talking about almost 150 cases, if I'm not mistaken. And he's been sentenced in three of these. Two of these, of course, are the Cypher case and another case related to do with the sale of gifts from the government, storage facility, so to speak. The Cypher case, like I said, especially interesting because Imran Khan had said that, you know, that was an evidence of foreign involvement in his overthrow. Now, of course, he's saying that it was just a piece of paper, but that piece of paper actually existed, in which a U.S. diplomat was on record saying that. Now, all of this is especially important because Pakistan is set to see elections in a few days, I believe in February, on the 8th of February, it's going to elections. And all polls, all indications seem to show that Imran Khan and his party are by far the most popular choice for number of voters. But, you know, one thing is that because these sentences Imran Khan can't contest. And more importantly, his party has not been allowed to use its traditional symbol, which is a cricket bat. Imran Khan being, of course, a very famous cricketer as well. Many of the party candidates contesting his independence. And this follows months and months of crackdown on his political party, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party. Many erstwhile leaders leaving the party, leaving politics altogether because of the extent of pressure that the establishment was applying on them. And what we saw was a very rare phenomenon during this whole period of the past one and a half years, which is that two traditional rival parties, the Pakistan Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Pakistan People's Party of Bilawal Bhutto, the party of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, who have been traditional rivals for almost two decades, uniting with clearly the patronage or clearly the approval of the military to form this kind of a government which succeeded Imran Khan. And this was the government which, you know, massively cracked down on the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party of Imran Khan and basically, inflicted a considerable amount of damage on it. A lot of leaders, like I said, leaving the party or facing a number of cases by which they were not able to continue to be in active politics anymore. So the battle lines definitely drawn for the elections in Pakistan. Now, Imran Khan will definitely appeal these two verdicts. The judiciary has also behaved in a number of varying ways. So we really can't say, unlike in some other countries, what position the judiciary might take on his case. It's possible that they might suspend the sentence. It's possible that, you know, they might take a more favorable verdict towards him. But what remains is a very fascinating situation where we have a personality and a party, more a personality, who is actually sort of defiant in many ways towards the establishment and has managed to garner a fair amount of popularity for that. And I think we also need to sort of see this in the context of a deep systemic crisis in Pakistan's economy, in Pakistan's society as well. The country, of course, has gone repeatedly to the IMF. It has been complete. The people facing massive amounts of inflation, the cost, not only the cost of living, but at every level, there have been economic woes, which no government, including Imran Khan's, has been able to sort of face in any way. So Imran Khan having the benefit of being sort of seen as an outsider, even now, because of the persecution he's faced, an outsider, someone who's, you know, against all these entrenched interests. So all this together, a very, very, you know, unique political situation in Pakistan. Right now, we have three parties, the two parties which were earlier together, that is the Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, are now contesting separately. We have the PTI led by Imran Khan. So there's basically a three-party contest here. In between all this, there's, of course, also, I think, the left position, which needs to be, you know, I think, followed as well. There's a lot of the two powerful, significant left forces in Pakistan have combined together and are presenting a very different and alternative agenda, which basically poses four fundamental questions to the people as to why is it that Pakistan is time and again to go to the IMF? Why is it that, you know, there's this almost, politicians keep cycling around, but nonetheless, there is no structural solution to the problems of it that the people are facing. Why is it that so much deindustrialization has happened in the country? And why is it that, you know, ultimately people are almost dependent on even very basic needs, for the basic economy to function, for grants from the IMF? These are very fundamental questions that people are going to confront. They have to decide in this election. So we'll come back next week. By next week, I think the election results will be out. Very, very interesting elections in a very important country in Asia.
It's very interesting because in the last parliamentary election, Prashant, Imran Khan's party got over 30% of the vote. I think somewhere near 32%, if I'm not mistaken. And when you add up Sharif's vote with Bhutto's vote, the other two main parties, they're just about more than Imran Khan's party. Just about. I think Sharif's vote, the Nawaz party, got about 20-some percent, and the Bhutto party, People's Party, got about 10-12%. Very interesting how they've been able to get him out of here for this election and maybe make it hard for him to return, although he remains one of the most popular candidates, popular politicians in Pakistan. Also a phenomenal all-rounder when it comes to cricket. We remember him fondly coming into bowl. On the other side was Sarfraz Nawaz, another great fast bowler from Pakistan. You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you from People's Dispatch. There's Prashant here today. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. I almost said I'm Zoe because I'm so used to saying her name right after yours, Prashant. It's a tough, tough period in the world. Lots of wars, lots of conflicts and so on. Very quick report for you, friends, on what's been happening with Iran. Now, the war in Gaza, the bombing of Gaza, has in fact created a great mood in the Middle East of anger and frustration with the fact that Israel seems to be getting away with genocide, for which reason many groups around the Middle East, Ansar Allah, the lead of this in Yemen, closing down the Red Sea channel, saying that we're doing this in support of the Palestinians, Hezbollah pinning down Israeli troops in the northern part of Israel along the perimeter with Lebanon, Hezbollah playing a major role there, and then various other militia groups in Syria, in Iraq, and in Jordan are frustrated, wanting to do something. There was an attack at a U.S. base. They keep calling it a remote U.S. base. You wonder why there's a U.S. base in Jordan, in that sort of knuckle area of Jordan beneath Syria. Well, it's from that base that the United States ran a lot of operations in its attempt to destabilize Syria, during the heart of that conflict. At any rate, in this base, there was an attack. Some U.S. service persons died, soldiers died. Well, the reaction has been interesting. Firstly, the cliched responses came from the United States government. You saw Mr. Biden and Lloyd Austin, who had been ill, made a return. Lloyd Austin at his press conference on the 1st of February said something which I think all U.S. presidents have said ever since 1823 Monroe Doctrine. He said, "We will respond when we choose, where we choose, and how we choose." I mean, those of us who cover the United States know and are familiar with this cliche. But Mr. Austin also said something that demonstrates the kind of bravado in the U.S. government. He said, "Well, these militia groups have a lot of capability." He paused for dramatic effect. And then he said, "But we have more, so we can bomb them." It's very interesting. The U.S. government, Biden, Austin, and others have been talking about these groups as Iranian-backed proxies or Iranian-backed militias. Ansar Allah, Hezbollah, Qatayb, this, that, and the other in Syria and in Iraq. Now, what's interesting is two things. Number one, it's pretty clear that these are not really Iran-backed in the way that one understands. These are Iran-supported organizations. Hezbollah is supported by Iran. But Hezbollah has a history that is prior to Iran's involvement. It has a prehistory around the Israeli occupation of Beirut from 1982. It has a history of fighting the Marines in Beirut and so on. It's not an Iran proxy. These organizations have their own history. Ansar Allah is, in fact, an organization that goes back to the period of the fight against Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was the president of unified Yemen after the unification of Yemen. And also, Ansar Allah goes back to the 9th century. I mean, for God's sake, long before Shiism comes to Persia, the Zaydis set up an emirate in northern Yemen in somewhere around the late 900s. They have a long history. And by the way, Zaydi Shiism, for those who don't know, has much more in common with Sufism and in fact, Sunniism than with Iranian Shiism. It's really kind of illiteracy to talk about these things as if they're all Iranian puppets. Second thing is, Iran doesn't want a conflict. Iran, in fact, has made a public statement saying that these groups should stop randomly attacking U.S. positions. Very interesting. Well, they don't want to be bombed by the United States at this time. They are not ready for a hot war. The U.S. seems to be trigger happy, ready for a hot war in Venezuela again, ready for a hot war in Iran, and ready for a hot war with China. The Iranians say, "Not for us, friends." Lloyd Austin, full of bluster, "We'll respond where we want." Meanwhile, here we go. Iranians saying, "We don't want a war. Put those guns back in the holster. This is not the time for a showdown." Then, Prashant, in the Sahel region, a whole other demand, saying put the guns back in the holster. What are those governments saying in the Sahel region of Africa?
Right, Vijay, I think what we're seeing in the Sahel region is probably a culmination of a process that has been taking place for many years now, which is that Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have left ECOWAS, the West African regional bloc for supposedly economic cooperation, etc., etc. Now, ECOWAS has been in the news, especially in the latter half of 2023, for the kind of regressive positions it took on a variety on the coup in Niger, and how out of touch it seemed to be with the people in its own countries. Now, ECOWAS had 15 countries, with these three countries leaving, it has come down to 12 countries, right? And but if you look at the landmass, because Mali, being such a huge country, has left, it's a considerable blow to its landmass. But I think more important is the fact that it's a considerable blow to its reputation, its prestige as a bloc of countries in the region, because in many ways it has been exposed in the aftermath of the coup in Niger in July 2023, when, you know, it almost seemed to act like an agent of French imperialism by threatening an armed intervention, despite the fact that the coup in Niger was actually welcomed by its people, that earlier coups in Mali and Burkina Faso had also been welcomed. Even in earlier occasions, they had taken a very negative stand towards these coup d'etat, or let's not call them coups as much as, you know, military takeovers, because we've discussed this before. The military takeovers in those regions have been kind of different from what you would the traditional military takeovers that we saw in Latin America, for that matter, which are basically CIA-sponsored operations. These seem to be operations where a section of junior officers, pushed back against rulers who were considered too close to France, and seemed to sort of encapsulate in trying to manage a vast popular sentiment on the ground against the presence of France and against the presence of French proxies in the form of the leaders. Now, ECOWAS' response to the coup in Niger was to pretty much threaten invasion, an operation which quickly the wheels fell off, because we saw that, for instance, in Nigeria, which was one of the leading countries in ECOWAS, the Senate refused. In many other countries, we saw massive dissatisfaction over that possibility. And that itself, I think, was a huge dent to the credibility of ECOWAS itself. In the later months, ECOWAS sort of indicated that, you know, we're going to negotiate. We still believe that all these regimes are not so legitimate, but we'll somehow negotiate, etc., etc. But I think what ECOWAS is confronting right now is basically the fact that many of their countries face a massive crisis of legitimacy. Many of these leaders are seen pretty much as French proxies, as people implementing the agenda of France, whether it be Macky Sall, especially Macky Sall in Senegal, for instance. But the crisis even extends to people like Bola Tinubu in Nigeria, or, for instance, the leaders of Ivory Coast as well, many of these, Cote d'Ivoire as well, many of these places. I think there is a substantial crisis of legitimacy faced by these leaders. In Islamist insurgencies in many of these places, France not being able to, despite all its claims, not being able to provide any solution at all. And I think there is a massive sort of pushback that is taking place. And in general, across the region, a sort of a region-based pushback. And I think that is what has crystallized in the form of these military takeovers in these three countries. So what we're seeing also is the fact that in these three countries established a relationship into the form of the Alliance of Sahel States. They said that, you know, the attack on one of us would be considered an attack on the other. One key factor why the ECOWAS so-called invasion or intervention force did not take place. There's a great interview with Kwesi Pratt Jr. on Breakthrough News, the General Secretary of the Socialist Movement of Ghana, where he talks about some of these aspects, the fact that Niger has actually seen a considerable amount of growth since the coup, the fact that the economic subservience of many countries in West Africa to France is really what is hindering their development as well. And he poses some very interesting questions, so I would encourage all our viewers to watch it. But I think what this poses right now, we've been talking for about over a year and a half about how this is one of the most important regions in the world. A very successful pushback against French imperialism definitely taking place. A desire to sort of seize their destiny, seize control of their resources. But the question is that whether the rulers of that region, the new military rulers who have taken over, will be able to address those aspirations. So I would think that it's a definitely a very positive sign that these countries have exposed ECOWAS for what it is. I think for the ECOWAS leaders themselves, this is a very important question. It's a wake-up call for the people in the country that remain, the countries that remain in ECOWAS, also a very important moment right now.
Yeah, I can't, you know, say that I agree more than that, because I agree with everything you just said. You know, as I said, this today our show, Prashant, is really so much about war and destruction, and we can't avoid that. These are the compelling issues of our time, and here we are. Yesterday, 1st of February, you know, Lloyd Austin, one side of the Atlantic, full of bluster, saying, you know, we'll attack whoever we want, perhaps even Iran. And then the European Union, 27 countries gathering together, deciding to put $54 billion or 50 billion euros in the pockets of the Ukrainians to continue that war. This has been an interesting dance. In December, Viktor Orban of Hungary said that he would veto any attempt to continue this war in Ukraine, that a peace agreement must be found, and so on. Well, Orban meets Zelensky in the at the inauguration of the Argentinian president, Javier Milei. They had some conversations. They didn't really publicly say what they talked about. But what most people are saying is that at the EU meeting in December, when Orban said we are going to veto, he thought he would get support from other countries, where there's a kind of recognition and exhaustion in the population with this war, that other states may say, okay, fine, let's pull everybody to the negotiating table. He didn't get any support. And then EU came back and said, well, we are going to reconsider your standing in the EU if you don't go along with this. In fact, Hungary received a lot of money from the EU. So the EU then essentially blackmailed Viktor Orban. Viktor Orban, after the vote, saying this 54 billion will be given, we withdraw our veto. After that, Mr. Viktor Orban said, we will not succumb to blackmail. Well, you just did. You just buckled under EU blackmail. And Charles Michel can, you know, spin this as much as he wants on behalf of the EU. That's effectively what this was. Now, interestingly, the U.S. military establishment, Navy Admiral Sam Paparo, gave a statement to the Senate Armed Services Committee where he said something interesting. And I think people need to follow sometimes what these military people say. He said that it is important that the West continue to support Ukraine and its ambitions against the Russians, not because of Russia, not even because of Ukraine, but because of the important message this will send to China, that if the West buckles in Ukraine, said Navy Admiral Sam Paparo, then the Chinese will believe, look, there's nobody holding us back. If we want to go and seize three uninhabited islands next to Taiwan, nobody's going to say anything. You know, they don't have the fortitude to continue. Very interesting revelation by Mr. Paparo. Open statement that really they don't care so much about the human lives and suffering in Ukraine or the question of weakening Russia. This is a much bigger geopolitical game, and he puts the map down on the table. In terms of the war in Ukraine, it is now almost universally acknowledged that the front line just can't move. This $54 billion is really about shoring up the front line. The front line is not able to shift. There is going to be no improvement of the situation, which again begs the question, why not come to the negotiating table? If nobody else wants them to come to the negotiating table, the European farmers, Prashant, certainly do. Just in the brief time we have, what have these European farmers been up to?
Right, Vijay. I mean, I think it's important to note that the media in many parts, especially the Western countries, have sort of portrayed it as farmers resisting green policies or being intransigent or whatever, they're being unwilling to change. But we have a couple of good pieces on the People's Dispatch side about the protests in France, and an article that appeared on the Workers' Party of Belgium site, which really kind of, I think, paints a very different picture of why farmers across Europe are protesting. There have been protests in Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, all these countries, protests in Poland taking place earlier. Ukraine war, one key factor, the kind of subsidies that EU countries gave to grain from Ukraine was definitely a factor. But I think what these farmers in many of these countries are protesting is as much the fact that a bulk of their, you know, a bulk of the huge amount of profit has been made by agribusiness companies at this point of time, whereas the farmers have been struggling. The consumers, of course, facing, you know, inflation, facing a huge cost, what is called the cost of living crisis. But farmers also really facing a massive crisis. They haven't been getting the kind of prices that they should be deserving. The amount of land that is under, you know, agriculture, in small farmers are increasingly vanishing. A huge amount of land being taken over by big corporates. And it is these big corporates who are also getting the benefits of various programs, including what is called a CAP from the European Union. It's the big farmers, the big corporates who seem to be benefiting from all these policies. So the smaller farmers, the individual farmers, really in a very bad shape, you know, really doing economically very poorly, while these big companies are really profiting. And I think that is the angle that needs to be looked into, as opposed to being seen as farmers just being resistant to you know, any green transition policies, which are really important at this point of time. And of course, also the fact that the EU bureaucracy itself, the kind of bureaucratic hurdles it has placed, the fact that when it comes to many of these policies, there has been absolutely no consultation with the farmers and the workers who are involved in agriculture. All of these are factors I think the farmers are trying to stress at this point. And it would be very wrong to sort of see this as a farmers versus environmentalism debate, which it is very unfortunately, I think, being presented. Whereas I think it's more on terms of farmers posing very big questions about the nature of economy itself.
And there you have it, friends. Give the people what they want, brought to you from People's Dispatch. Today it's Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Next week, 160th show. Zoe will be back. See you then.
Overcome. We shall.